All right. Hello, everyone. Good morning. So I'm going to talk about something a little different today, but I'm going to do my best to tie it back to evolution every step along the way. So I'm going to be talking about transcription factors, which, you know, it turns out are one of the key factors actually driving the selection and evolution we've been talking about. So to start out, a little bit of perspective, like I really like, you know, every now and then I like to blow my own mind just to think about this. So the stuff we're studying, it's happening inside of you, you know, like that's, you know, we like to abstract things away to like these, you know, models, but you know, we're actually studying how life works, which is pretty mind-blowing. It's happening inside you right now. So, you know, as a human, we don't even really know this number, but it's something like your 100 trillion cells. And then, you know, essentially every cell in your body has an identical copy of the genome. All right, so should be, you know, facts you knew, but, you know, just ponder this for a moment. And then, you know, when you think about your genome, there are these things called genes and all sorts of other things. And genes are basically, you know, blueprints for making proteins. And of course, there's non-coding RNAs and other things that also play important roles. Humans have about 20,000 proteins. The stick is great. So here we're kind of left with this kind of interesting quandary, if you will, where, you know, we have all these different cell types with vastly different morphologies, but, you know, they're all basically have the same blueprint encoding them. So first kind of, you know, early morning pondering question for you is, how do you explain this wide range of cellular form and function? Yes.
And on your previous slide, the argument that every cell has identical copy of the genome, that's not exactly true.
Yeah.
And one thing that I can trace down to this audience is the situation, this is a good approximation. Like, you know, there were physicists that were arguing yesterday that things aren't truly in equilibrium in biology.
This is a good point, and this points out the disconnect between what I said and what is written. I said essentially the same, but I think you raise a very interesting point. Does anyone want to weigh in on that?
Well, I guess if you say that SNPs, somatic mutations would bring things apart, so what makes what you can call being similar between any two humans, as to be caused by something that's common between these two, it can't be random.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the other thing is, I'm gonna, you know, just to weigh in myself. Like, I'm kind of gonna contradict myself in a way, because later on I'll be talking about, you know, of course we know that, you know, in your cell there are, you know, variation between your genomes, and then I'm going to be talking about cases where even a single nucleotide can change, you know, expression phenotype, for example. Yes.
I was actually wondering about the number 20,000 proteins, 20,000 genes, because I tend to think about alternative splicing, so it's four or five times that number.
Yep.
Which may just straight feed into what you're talking about.
So the 20,000, I mean, you could probably multiply that by 10 or 100, you know, it really, it's a good point, because, I mean, when we say a protein, for example, we're really talking about, you know, several potentially highly biochemically distinct entities that, you know, they come from the same region of the genome, but, you know, they can perform very different roles. So, yeah, a good point, too. Zero, yeah. Which is, that's an interesting debate altogether in and of itself. This question of the function, what proportion of the genome is functional. So all right, so this is good. We're already Getting to some interesting things in the introduction. All right, so similar genome, different cells. Let's leave it at that. And now you're really going to be mad at me for saying same. But here, you know, I'm going to come out and say that, you know, at least so human chimp, your set of proteins are virtually identical. And even like if you go as far back to mouse, you know, you can find one-to-one pretty clear orthologs. With, you know, in quotation marks, human and mouse essentially have the same basic set of genes. So you're probably going to guess where I'm setting this up for. So, you know, it's the utilization of the genes that turns out to be important. So, of course, not all genes are used at all the time. And genes are expressed in certain developmental stages, different environments, tissue types, or cellular states. And then, so the topic of today's talk is about gene regulation, which is basically the process controlling when these genes are utilized. Okay, so transcription factors. This is, again, I wanted to start with just kind of high level, just to get everyone caught up. So basically, you know, this is a very, you know, this is like an entire field condensed into a sentence. So, you know, it's a generalization. But they're proteins whose job is to turn genes on and off, turn transcription on and off in response, often in response to specific cues. So as humans, even this number is not really well hammered out, but we're going to say there's about 1,700 transcription factors in the human genome. And again, this is not taking into account different splicing isoforms. There's 1,700 genes that are transcription factors. And you know, they have, again, just like any lots of different types of genes, there's many different types of transcription factors. There's ones that are only function in your brain, there's ones that are involved in the immune system, and there's developmental stage specific transcription factors. And you know, the way these things work is that they interact with the genome by recognizing these short sequences. And these are also kind of a simplification, but it's kind of convenient to represent the sequences that they recognize as these motifs, which you might have seen before. And the basic idea is every transcription factor has a set of DNA sequences it can bind to. They're often in humans, there are 10 bases, probably between like 6 to 10 bases seems to be where most of them fall. And the way you read these things is, let's just pick this one here. So at the first position, you can have either an A or a G, but you know, you don't want a C. A C or a T. This next position, you always want a T, always a G. You know, here, a T or a G. And really, I mean, these are just kind of visual summarizations of underlying numbers, and the numbers what we can use to scan and predict where transcription factors might bind. But the key here is that there's degeneracy, right? So it's not like one transcription factor recognizes a single 8-base sequence. There's actually, you know, as you can see, there's degeneracy and this general rule at most positions in these motifs. And again, these, oh, yes, or not. Oh, the total height is the information content at that position. So basically, there's a 2-bit scale here, and if you always have a T, that's 2 bits of information, right? You know that, you know, that's your information content. And if there is a position here where there's almost nothing going on, like here, it means, you know, it's probably the A is like 30%, G is like 27%, and the others, you know, add up. So it's like, you know, there's not a whole lot of information at that position. Yes. So there's lots of ways to do this. I'm going to talk about one of them in my talk today called a protein binding microarray. But you can do, for example, a ChIP-seq experiment, which will tell you where in a given cell population a transcription factor is binding. And you pull it down, and then you get a bunch of sequences. And then you can imagine just doing some sort of enrichment, statistical enrichment, to pull out, you know, these motifs. And again, it's like a whole like subfield of where I come from, where people study, you know, how do you actually derive these motifs. And there's more advanced models than these, because a lot of people would argue there's actually interdependencies between positions, for example. And, you know, this simple model can't capture that. But again, for visualization purposes, I'm just going to show them like this, with understanding that there's much more complicated models you can develop. Okay, so regulatory elements transcription factors bind to. So we're learning more and more that this near is really an approximation, but especially in higher quote-unquote eukaryotes. But the idea is that, you know, you have within some fixed distance these things will bind, and depending on chromatin looping and other factors, they'll control the expression of a gene. And again, human, we're back to this 20,000 number, which you can certainly argue. But let's just stick with that just for the purposes of this bullet point, at least. And, you know, really, we don't really know what the answer is here. And again, this is kind of, you know, getting into, you know, the limit of what we know. But it's pretty clear at this point, at least in human, that any given gene is controlled by at least dozens of transcription factors. And you know, this number could be hundreds or more. And again, this is because certain genes, you can imagine that you might want to have a very tight control of their expression. They could be expressed only under certain time points or in certain tissue types, et cetera. And kind of the point of this talk today is that, we're interested in kind of this basic ingredient here. So if we want to understand how these transcriptional networks actually function, we really need to, we would argue that one of the key ingredients is just understanding what sequences a given transcription factor can and can't bind to. And once you have that information, the goal is to start putting that into models that we can use for all sorts of applications. So just to make sure we're all on board here, we're looking at a region of the genome with three genes. We can zoom into this promoter region, we'll say, of this gene. You can zoom all the way down to the DNA level. And let's say we have a transcription factor who has evolved to recognize this sequence. Then here's two places it might bind in the genome. So two things that roughly match this motif. Again, I kind of highlighted the degeneracy here. There's a T at this position. Here there's a G at that position. And you can see it'll tolerate either based on this model. And then you can have another transcription factor that recognizes a totally different sequence that binds here. So zooming out, we're looking there. So now maybe this combination of those three, perhaps in that specific orientation, is sufficient to turn this gene on in a certain condition. And of course, the other genes stay off because they don't have that combination of transcription factors binding. And maybe this guy over here requires a totally different set of Easter eggs to get turned on. Okay, so transcription factors themselves as a protein class are incredibly diverse. So I think this is another kind of step back and blow your mind moment. So these are all from crystal structures. They're cartoons showing different ways that transcription factors have kind of figured out how to recognize DNA in a sequence-specific manner. And you might think naively that maybe there's like one basic shape, and then you can kind of modulate that, and that'll be sufficient to bind a wide range of different sequences. But it turns out that these things have figured out lots of different strange ways of interacting with DNA. So here we have these are the BZIP class of transcription factors that bind DNA in a scissor grip, it's often referred to. So it's a heterodynamic or homodimer interaction. So the two alpha helices are two different proteins that come together and kind of form this scissors and fit right into the DNA. So that's kind of cool. Down here, you have this puny little thing called the AT hook, which is really only, I think, 7 or 8 amino acids, and that's sufficient for it to recognize AT-rich regions. And then you have these kind of monstrous conglomerations of beta folds and alpha helices, like STAT here, that again, they're totally different way of recognizing DNA. And again, each one of these is kind of a different family that I'm showing. I kind of picked one example from each family. And even within families, there's variations even structurally. It depends on the class. So BZIPs in particular, just about all of them can bind. They need to bind as homodimers. They can't bind as monomers. But they also heterodimerize quite a bit within the class. So it's and there's also across family interactions that happen. So you wouldn't necessarily call them dimers, but they clearly there's like going back to Rob's allostery talk that even the proteins often don't even have to interact physically. Where one can bind, it's enough to change the shape of the DNA so the other can bind. So there's interactions, at all sorts of different levels of these things. Okay, so now, we can get a little more evolution-y. So let's just look across eukaryotes at how these families are distributed. So we're looking at fungi up here, animals, plants, and then protist-type things down here. And that's my catch-all phrase. So now we're just going to look at, there's about 90 families of transcription factors. So each one of these rows is a family. So C2H2 zinc fingers are here. Homeodomains are here. Helix, loop, helix, BZIPs, they're all, each one of these is one of these rows. And now each entry is just telling you how many genes code for the given protein in the given organism. The key is over here. So, one striking feature is a lot of them are zero, right? So a lot of these families are not present in any organism. Another striking figure is a lot of them, there's a lot of copies of them. So like we're going up to 600 different genes, for example, for C2H2 zinc fingers. And you know, at this resolution, we're mice, right? So we're about the same where there's, you know, I think 700 or 800 in human. That's about half the transcription factors in human are from a single class, which is kind of interesting. But then, you know, you can look and see, you know, they're pretty much, you know, C2H2s are fairly ubiquitous. And, you know, just based on the way we set this heat map up, you know, you can see there's kind of a collection that you might think maybe these are, this is like the ancient toolkit of transcription factors, right? Because they're present across pretty much all forms of life, more or less. And again, these include C2H2s, MIB, homeoboxes, helix, loop helix, BZIPs. So these things, you know, pretty much anything you sequence, you're going to find them. But with exceptions, though, you know, sometimes they get lost on lineages. And then, yes? So we're defining these based on their DNA binding domain. So these are entirely different gene families, too. Yep. So we're defining them basically thinking back to those structures I was just showing you. So it's basically each one is a structural class. So we're dividing them only based on these DNA binding domains. And interesting thing about transcription factors is they're thought to evolve highly modularly. So you can keep the DNA binding domain pretty much the same, but then you can attach like a new activation domain or like a new, you know, all sorts of different domains to that protein, and then it can suddenly, you know, do a totally different thing. But yeah, we're basing this on a DNA binding domain.
So are you looking for the set of known proteins in animals and then looking out to humans, or are you taking information independently derived from other systems and then looking across?
That's a good question. So we're basically, procedurally, we're using the PFAM database. So it's a database of basically domains within proteins that have been created from pretty much all forms of life. And we're scanning for these models and saying, you know, do we find matches, how many matches do we find in any given genome? And we only use, so this axis was a bit of a pain in the ass because basically I had to figure out, you know, go through all the literature and say, you know, is there support for a protein carrying this PFAM domain actually being a DNA binding domain of a transcription factor. So everything that's a row here is something that has evidence that it can bind DNA specifically and it can alter expression. Turns out there's about 90 of these families. Yeah. They're also in prokaryotes, and there's, the question was, what about prokaryotes? And their DNA binding domains and transcription factors are also present in prokaryotes. They're very different families. Prokaryotes tend to recognize longer sequences, which is, there have been interesting evolutionary arguments, like Mike's made some and others have made some about why that is. But they tend to, structurally, they look pretty different. There's the closest thing we have to what prokaryotes have. The homeodomains are from a helix-turn-helix family, and a lot of the prokaryotic transcription factors are helix-turn-helix, which is just the basic shape. But you know, they're pretty different. And archaea kind of have a mixture of their basal transcriptional machinery is very similar to the eukaryotes, where there's the TATA binding protein and things like that, but then their activators and repressors are more similar to bacteria. Okay. Yeah, so here we're counting basically the proteins that code for transcription factors. So this is, humans have, say, you know, 20,000 or whatever genes, and of them, about 1,700 are transcription factors. And we're doing this just by scanning for these PFAM domains. So you take the proteome, you scan a given protein and say, hey, that looks like a homeodomain, and then you count it plus one for the homeodomains. Yeah, so there are, I don't know if I put one, no, I think these are only single family, but one is the POU homeobox family, where there's two different DNA binding domains that are, you know, they have to be at a certain distance from each other, but then that, you know, confers a whole new specificity to the family. Another thing that I should mention is a lot of these within a family, you'll often have multiple DNA binding domains. So C2H2 zinc fingers, you can have up to 30 or 40 C2H2 domains all stacked next to each other. And it's largely thought to be kind of an additive thing where you can add up kind of the specificity of each DNA binding domain, and that explains your motif. C2H2s are kind of a thorn in my side because they're very complicated. Like, you can imagine if you have 40 different DNA binding domains, and in any given context, you might only be using some subset of those. You know, it's like you can have lots of different motifs you can recognize. So, you know, for this project, our goal is like, let's figure out all the binding specificities for all the transcription factors, and you know, if a C2H2 can recognize 50 itself, then you're kind of like, oh man. Plus, there's a lot of them. But yeah, that's an important point. You can have multiple DNA binding domains within a given transcription factor.
I think we danced around the edge of this, but just for the students, I think it would be useful to point out that PFAM is heavily biased toward animal protein.
Yeah, so that's a good point.
And then after that, fungi and plants. And so where it looks like there's a whole bunch of, you know, that animals might have more transcription factors than anything else, or plants might, that's probably a reflection of the...
Yeah.
Database,
yeah. Yeah, and I think that is true. And just there's not as many people studying them in these other. So like when you get down to, you know, some of these organisms here, it's not, you know, it's possible that they might have a reduced set of transcription factors, but you know, it's also likely that, you know, if you don't know what 90% of the genes are doing in a genome, and you know, just they could have their own set of transcription factors we just don't know about.
Ways of binding DNA that we are missing, or whether particularly animals and fungi have lost entire ways of binding that we would be detecting. So can you speak to that a little bit?
It's a very interesting topic. I would say that, you know, you definitely get a little bit of both. It's kind of easier to be sure about things that are lost because you can find, you know, on some of these, well, I don't know, I wouldn't even say that, maybe.
Because if it wasn't an animal and fungi, unless you took a plant-specific query, you wouldn't catch that.
Yeah, so let's look at the plants over here. So, you know, here's a whole lot of things. Like, I mean, these things have like hundreds of copies in a given plant genome. And you look across, you know, to, oh, sorry, I'm going the wrong way. If you look up to like fungi and animals, you know, they're just not there at all. So, I mean, it's possible, I guess, you know, parsimony to me would suggest that plants, you know, evolved these themselves. And that's what, you know, people have made the argument that these are solutions to the problem that plants have figured out on their own, as opposed to this being some ancient family that was lost on multiple lineages. But I mean, I'd be interested to hear what people in the room have to say to that. But
I think it's a detection issue in a lot of cases. Because, you know, the homeobox genes for the longest time people thought were just in animals, and it wasn't until the knotted mutant came up in plants, and you know, people were trying to amplify homeobox genes from other organisms and couldn't, and it wasn't until you get this outgroup in the plants that it became clear that there were homeobox genes, but they were far enough outside of our search parameters that we couldn't see them. And we've been, you know, if you take genes that are conserved in the animals, and now we look in the organisms, we're saying kind of flatulence, the PFAM model doesn't detect them, and yet it's clear that they have all of the important preserved residues, and you can get structure predictions. My guess is that there is a continuum, and in many of these cases, we're not detecting them simply because of the reality of PFAM.
Yeah.
And it's restrictive because, so, you know, if you look at that part you have boxed in right there, those have only been studied in the plants, the models have been built based on the plant sequences. It could be that if people go in and make the models now from the plant component sequences, that, you know, you're going to start to see that these, there's a richer evolutionary history for a lot of these.
Yeah.
Well, I guess the corollary of that is that there are certain proteins that were thought to be universal in eukaryotes, and then people all of a sudden discovered there were eukaryotes that A, didn't have them, and B, had invented something else like kinetic or proteins in kinetoblasts. So I think we're far too conservative about assuming the branches of life have invented new ways of doing things, and so that Michael's point about, you know, there may be all sorts of transcription factors that have been invented in less studied lineages is almost certainly right.
Yep. Yeah.
So I went to the Blackboard talk yesterday on dark matter, and the whole theory is based on the fact that there's this amazing coincidence, almost the fraction of dark matter estimated is about the same as the fraction of ordinary stuff, and so there's a theory to expand. I think here, if we ever calculate anything and then it turns out that the humans are at the top of the pile, then you're almost certainly wrong.
I like that.
That's a good way to start thinking.
Yeah.
And so mouse is your human proxy here. Mm-hmm. It says, oh, we're the best. And so you're almost certainly wrong.
Although there are certainly organisms, like non-animal organisms, have more transcription factors. So, I mean, at least there's that. But yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, there's clearly a bias. You see this large swath up here in the animals, and you know, does that really mean that animals have more transcription factors, or just mean that we're more interested in studying animals, right? Yeah.
So, just sort of visually scanning it, it does look like there's a lot where you actually have things in the plants and then the non-opisthocons below, so non-animals and fungi below, right? So
yep.
At least a couple of cases
where
that probably suggests that it's an ancient feature that was lost in our lineage.
Yep.
And so, I mean, who knows if more of those might be out there. And I guess my other question was more of a technical one. Were you taking PFAM and analyzing the content of PFAM, or were you taking the proteins in PFAM and using those as queries for blast searching and Markov models?
I think the former. So exactly what I'm doing is saying, here's a homeobox model from PFAM. I'm going to scan the proteome and find matches above the detection threshold, and that's what I'm identifying as my transcription.
So you download all the genomes, and then you use that to query, and then you use the Markov model with blast.
Yep. Anyone else? All right, cool. This is good. I was hoping we'd spend some time on this slide, so thank you, everyone. Anything else? Okay, all right, so here's the important thing for what I'm going to talk to you about today, is that we don't know what sequences any of these things are binding to. And, you know, that's a problem. So here is our weapon of choice, the protein binding microarray. These were invented by Martha Bullock at Harvard. And when I was joining Tim Hughes' lab as a postdoc, he just, you know, he worked with Martha quite a bit, and he was working on ramping up the throughput of these things. But the basic idea is you have a given transcription factor you're interested in assaying, and you make a plasmid that contains a DNA binding domain and a GST tag, and you have these double-stranded microarrays, and you bind that plasmid, you bind the transcription factor to the array, and then you see what lights up, and then you look under the hood at the probe sequences, and that'll tell you what sequences the transcription factor likes to bind to. So a little more, so the reference of the original papers down here from Martha's group, but just about the design, which I think is the cool part of these, so there's about 40,000 probes on them. Each one has 35 base pair unique sequence and a 25 base pair common linker. And their probes are set up so that any possible 10 base sequence you could name shows up once on the array. And therefore, every possible 8 base sequence is going to show up 32 times on 32 different probes, 32 different sequence flanking contexts. So you can take the median of these 32 instances of every one of the 33,000 8-mers, and that's a score for your transcription factor, how well it likes to bind to that given 8-mer. So the nice thing here is you're not directly measuring, you're getting direct measurements to pretty much every possible 8-mer. We're not making any assumptions about the model, so like those position weight matrices motifs I was showing you earlier, we're not, assuming independence. We're just pretty much, you get a score for every 8-mer, and then you can do whatever you want in terms of building models from that. So they're nice and reproducible, and then the scores track well. We're not directly measuring KD or binding affinity, but the scores track well with the binding affinity. So this is what we're going to be using in this study. And so when I joined Tim's lab, this is kind of a simple and perhaps obvious but powerful observation, which is if you take a pair of proteins that have similar DNA binding domains, so I'm just saying they have similar amino acid sequences in their DNA binding domains, more often than not, they recognize similar DNA sequences. So Tim and Martha had just published this work where they pretty much assayed all the homeodomains in mouse. And one of the interesting findings here, as set up above, is that if you cluster things based on your protein sequence, so here this is just a clustal W, I think, tree, clustering only based on a DNA binding domain amino acid sequences, But now I'm going to plop down the motifs these things recognize, and they're color-coded. So you know, you just need to squint and see, like, hey, that thing's green, green, red, red, green. But you can go all along this tree, basically, and almost invariably, if you cluster together based on DNA binding domain, you are going to have a similar motif you recognize. And you know, there's a wide range. Even within homeodomains, you can see there's very different motifs they can recognize, so all sorts of different classes. But again, you know, these things, it's almost without exception, you find this rule to hold. Okay, so that's everything. So this is where they came up with this. They call it the 65% rule. And the idea here is that for any pair of transcription, yes? Musculus, about 160 homeodomains. So it's one of those columns I was showing on my big heat map. So we're looking inside one of those dots, the musculus homeobox dot in that heat map. And even within that, there's this huge diversity of the binding motifs.
Could you clarify to me why it's obvious that you have different proteins for the same sequence? Do they have like other parts of the protein are different? Is that why you only took the DNA binding domain?
So the DNA binding domain, I mean, again, within reason, it's the part of the protein that interacts directly with the DNA. There can be residues outside the DNA binding domain that can alter specificity, but for the most part, the key determinants are found within the region that's directly fitting into the DNA. What was the other part?
I'm just curious as to why there are so many proteins that seem to have similar DNA binding specificity. Why would you need that?
So that is where we're getting to another interesting evolutionary question. So one thing that you can imagine is if you have a protein that I'm purposely trying to use unloaded evolutionary terms, but it can recognize a specific set of DNA sequences. Now let's copy it, so now we have two copies of it. Then with that second copy, you can do a bunch of things, right? You can kind of tweak the specificity a little bit so it recognizes a slightly different set. You could attach a different activation domain to it so it gets activated under a different condition. So it's kind of like, it's a way of, you know, it's a way of evolving things.
Can you say a little more about how well this method approximates where you actually see these transcription factors? If you go back to your previous slide.
The big tree thing? Yeah. So this is a key point. So this gets into, it's more complicated than I've told you. So let's just pick one of these that say it recognizes TTAA. You scan the human genome, for example, you're going to find millions of matches to TTAA. And this transcription factor, I guarantee, is only going to bind a small fraction of this. So at the very beginning of my talk, when I said this is an ingredient to building models for predicting where these things bind. So these are by no means like, all right, we've solved this, the problem's done. This is just an ingredient explaining how these things work. And some of the things in the cell that are going on that govern where these things bind, so a major determinant is the chromatin structure. So in the human genome, the majority of your genome's wrapped up in nucleosomes at any given time. So these things can't even bind to those regions. So there's one. They frequently, most of them, prefer to bind in open chromatin. Another is these things interact with one another. So if you think back to my Easter egg drawings, you know, they often, you know, one won't bind without another being present. And then, you know, these things are proteins too, so, you know, they need to be activated often, or, you know, so there's a lot going on. And chromatin looping, there's a million different factors that go into controlling where these things bind. And then the converse thing, I think you also made another good point, is So you take a ChIP-seq experiment for a given transcription factor, and you know, people like figure one in your paper is going to be, look, we pulled out the motif we expected, it's enriched in our peaks. But then when you look under the hood and say, well, all right, what fraction of, you know, my 100,000 peaks actually have a match to that motif, it's often like, you know, only 10 or 20%. So what's going on with the other 80%? There's a lot of different theories about that. One of them is, you know, it could just be experimental noise. Another is that it's being recruited by another factor, so these things often, you have one factor bind and it recruits another factor, so you won't even find that other factor's motif there, it's just being recruited by something else. But that's another important point. So this is not like we've solved the answer. We just solved one thing, which is what they can bind to.
This is necessary, but not sufficient.
Perfect, yep.
Suggesting that they have overlapping function with their parallels. Do we know what the answer to that question is?
I don't think we do. That's a really good point. We've never tried that. Huh.
But other people, presumably not
analysts. Yeah, but I think, yeah, we could look at other data. No, that's a really good idea. Right now, this what we're looking at is only in mouse.
So that's all the parallels. Okay.
Later, we'll be looking at everything.
Ned. Just going back to the DNA microarray, how quantitative is like a spot on that?
Ah.
On that microarray, you know, does it depend on where the eight mark is?
Yeah.
DNA, is it reproducible from run to run? I'm just curious.
So you're asking me to relive the first 2 years of my postdoc, which were a bit of a nightmare. Yeah, but yeah, there are a lot of subtleties here. Any given probe, I would say there's kind of, you know, it's a glass half full, glass half empty thing. I'm pretty impressed. Like, I wouldn't trust a single probe, but, you know, as a whole, the probes are pretty amazing. Like, you can just sort by intensity and visually pick out, there's motif. There's biases as to the location of the motif on the probe. If you're too deep in towards the slide, then, you know, just you can imagine it's harder for the protein to wedge its way in there. And, you know, so that's the biggest bias we found, is the positional location. But that said, since we're taking 32 measurements of every 8-mer, it pretty much just washes out, and we take the median of that. So, you know, we know that there are these effects, and because of that reason, I usually don't like, you know, looking at the intensity of a single probe. That's why we do this 8-mer transformation. But still, I mean, it's like a given probe, and they're microarrays, so there's smudges and, you know, dust and crap on them. But, you know, in general, they're pretty solid measurements, I think, even the probes themselves.
Mm-hmm. So can you see that degeneracy in your motifs and the scar that happened?
That's an interesting question. So one of the things we always do is, like, supplemental figure one is, here's the motif we get, here's the motif you get from high throughput Celex, here's the motif you get from ChIP-seq, and, you know, qualitatively they match up pretty well. And then more quantitatively, I've spent a lot of time saying, you know, you can learn a model from a protein binding in microarray, how well can you predict ChIP-seq, how well can you predict Celex, and all these other things. We do tend to get a little more degeneracy in the protein binding microarrays, and this is kind of more of a philosophical debate in our little subfield about, well, is that because transcription factors really are degenerate and we're being more accurate in our measurements, or is it because of, like you mentioned, maybe it's some you know, artifact of the assays we're using. So the latest development we have now is we're trying to organize the setup where we've picked about 70 transcription factors from a wide range of classes, and we're going to assay them using protein binding microarrays, high throughput Celex, bacteria one hybrid. So all the different assays, ChIP-seq, everything we can, and then learn models from each, and then see how well you can predict across platforms. We can actually get at this, you know, try and tease apart, you know, what's, you know, platform specific versus the actual biology. Yeah. So that's another great raging debate going on, is this, how complex of a model do you need? I'm of the school of, I want the simplest model until you can prove that you need a more complex model. And, you know, I had this paper a couple of years ago that pissed a lot of people off that basically said that in most cases these simple models work really well. And we pretty much did exactly what you described, where we have two totally independent protein binding microarray designs, totally different probes for the same transcription factor. You learn a model from one and predict the intensities of the other. And for like 90% of the transcription factors we looked at, you could do pretty well just using a PWM. And then you get slightly better with more complicated models, but you know.
I think it would depend heavily on the mode of cross-regulation, the mode of binding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And also, I mean, there's clear cases where you need more complicated models. So I'm not going to say a PWM works for everything, where, you know, people have shown that two totally different modes a given transcription factor combined in, and you can't capture that with a PWM, or clear dinucleotide dependencies, you can't capture that. But I think in general, you know, it's kind of like, you know, everyone's using these PWMs, and it's good to see that at least, you know, this is all given the current state of the technology we have for measuring these things, but I would say, you know, they seem like a pretty reasonable approximation in most cases. Yeah.
Just on that point, are there any transcription factors known which allosterically change the preferred binding site?
Yeah. So that is a really cool thing, where we actually just published a paper where we haven't proven it's allostery, but we waved our hands a lot and said it's probably allostery. But you can find cases where... Yeah. So sorry.
Which case was that?
So it's a GABPA and a Kreb 1, but we used a custom set of these protein binding microarrays where, you know, we had the two binding sites for the two. They need to be at a certain distance from each other to cooperate. And then you can look at what happens only in the presence of GABPA, what sequences, what probes light up. You add in Kreb 1, what probes light up. And then you can see, like, there's different parts of the motif that are dependent on, you know, the presence of Kreb 1, and even ones that are nowhere near the Kreb binding site. And our argument is that maybe it's changing the shape. You know, we didn't prove there's allostery, but it's in the discussion. We're like, yeah, maybe it's allostery. But there's other examples too, like in the literature, where that is the case.
All right. Yeah.
That's a really interesting point, yeah, because, you know, presumably it's much, much, much more often you get a single nucleotide mutation within a binding site, right? It's not like you're going to get two mutations right next to each other. So yeah, in terms of drift, you know, you change one base at a time, right, evolutionarily. So yeah, so maybe that has helped contribute to how these things function. All right, so, okay, so the 65% rule. So again, here's the idea, is if you share two-thirds or more of your amino acids in your DNA binding domain, you recognize a nearly indistinguishable DNA sequence. And here's something that's interesting. So it has nothing to do with evolutionary distance. We tried a bunch of ways of looking at this. But by that, I mean, if you have a mouse transcription factor and you know its binding specificity, and you have a yeast transcription factor, you know its binding specificity, if they're above this cutoff, then those specificities are going to be similar. And we've tried a whole wide range of fancy machine learning methods for quantifying this, and, you know, we were happy to see that, again, this simple rule where you just align the amino acids and count mismatches works just about as well as any fancier method you can think of. We also tried only looking at the DNA contacting residues when they were known, and that, you know, it improved things slightly, but you're also throwing away a lot of the signal that way, so it didn't really improve this, at least in our scheme. And then it also works for RNA binding proteins. So this is one of these things where, you know, we took the same basic idea, applied it to RNA binding proteins instead. So Tim's lab, they developed this thing called RNA Compete, which is basically the RNA binding protein version of the protein binding microarrays. But, you know, computationally, I just apply my same code, basically change the T's to U's, and I'm ready. And it works, you know, just as well for the RNA binding proteins, which is cool. Okay. So, all right. So let's just say that, and I'm going to show you more quantitative data about the 65% thing. So just trust me for now that it's real, and then, you know, I'll show you that it's real, you know, just later. And it's all published too. So. But all right, so let's just say we believe that it's real, and we think it'll work for many families, because then I was only talking about homeodomains before. Then let's just say, you know, we have this mission to figure out as many transcription factor binding motifs as possible across all of life. Then, you know, because of this rule and because so many genomes have been sequenced, we actually have a fairly rational way of going about doing this. So Tim and I sat down, we said, all right, let's make our dream list of 2,000 transcription factors. You know, if you could pick any 2,000 transcription factors in a world to characterize, what would they be? And we had a few goals here. So one is we need to figure out if these, if the 65% rule even works for these other families. So I showed all these different families, and we want to know, does it apply to all of them? Is it a homeobox specific thing, or is it not? So you can imagine you can just pick pairs of proteins that are 90% similar, 80%, 70%, et cetera, and assay them to build up these models. Another is get as much bang for your buck as possible. So you can imagine if you have one transcription factor, you don't know its motif, and it has 300 other transcription factors that are similar to it, then it's buy one, get 300 free. So you probably want to pick that one. Okay, another one is, you know, here's where I'll have some fans leads. We wanted to make sure we weren't biasing for, you know, human and mouse. We wanted to go across as many clades as possible. And then, you know, we did want to focus on some of the major model organisms, just again, for the bang for your buck idea. So we focused on Arabidopsis, Dictyostelium, the slime mold, Ostreococcus, Neurospora, and mouse. And all right, so here's, you know, we're going back to a tree. This was the part where we basically, Tim and I spent a year going to evolution type meetings and just trying to meet as many people as we could that studied these interesting organisms. So on this tree here, there's a check mark where at the time there was at least one sequenced genome. A star means that the genome was in progress. An asterisk, I mean. And then the blue stars are where we could actually track down a collaborator that could provide us with some sort of template for running the protein binding microarray. So we need to create our constructs. So, you know, they sent us either DNA or RNA, or they already had clones or something. But you can see pretty much anywhere there's a check mark, there's some stars. So we're able to cover pretty much across all of the eukaryotes for this project. And so here's what finally happened. So Ali Yang is the lab technician in Tim's lab that did the majority of these experiments. And yeah, this is an amazing amount. She definitely is like the world record protein binding microarray person at this point. But she led kind of a large team of people experimentally. And in the end, we had about 1,000, over 1,000 transcription factors that we had. And we used pretty stringent quality control, and they all passed. You know, there's a lot of steps here, you know, this is even, you know, we picked 2,000, and for a lot of them, we couldn't even build a construct for various reasons. But we end up with 1,033 transcription factors, and again, we do this on duplicate, two totally independent arrays. We make sure the arrays, you know, match up in their predictions, you know, so we think it's pretty high quality. About 130 species are covered, coming from 54 different transcription factor families. Okay, and here's, you know, I just love showing these kind of things. So this is a mere sampling of some of the beautiful forms of life that we covered here. Okay, all right, so here's the 65% rule. So now we're going to actually have something quantitative finally. So this axis here, how similar is your DNA binding domain? This is, again, just align the amino acids and count mismatches. So 100 means you're identical completely. 0 means you have nothing in common. We're doing this within each family, so within each class, so each column in a big heat map at the beginning. And then this axis, there's a bunch of different ways of measuring this, but it's basically how similar is the DNA binding motif, the binding site that you recognize. In this point, in this case, we're just going to say you take the 8 MERS that score well on the array and just say how many are identical, and then, you know, divide by the total number of 8 MERS. Okay? All right, and then, you know, there's a lot of stuff on these, so I'm going to slowly walk you through them. And the key thing, so that this is this first one, the asterisk up here, this is the precision. So this is in the given bin, let's say how many of the pairs of proteins that fall in this bin do we do at least as good as most experimental replicates? And by most, I mean, I guess it's not most, as, you know, a lot of experimental replicates. So you draw a line and say, this is what I get with experimental replicates, you need to get better than that for us to say you have the same motif. So it's a pretty stringent line. The median here, this is just telling you, you know, just to let you know, so this means that if you're identical, you know, based on our assays, about, you know, 85% of your 8 MERS, top 8 MERS are going to be the same, you know, just to kind of calibrate things, and then, you know, there's some wiggle room around that. Okay, and then we're going to say, because we're using a 25th percentile of replicates, let's require you have to have at least 75% precision. So anytime your asterisk is above this line, we're going to say that's as good as experimental replicates. Okay, down here, cross-validation success rate across all of our bins based on where we draw our line. So just leave one out and see how well you can predict it. And then down here, this is the number of pairs. So within this bin, we had 86 pairs of transcription factors. And all right, so here's what we get for homeodomains. So before it was 65%, we have a lot more data. So look, you can see these N down here. These are pairs, but you know, like in this bin, we have like 30,000 data points. So let's play the game. So what's the precision? You know, pretty darn good. And then it starts to fall off. And at some point, it falls before what we prescribed as our threshold. So we'd say 70% is our cutoff for homeodomains. So anything above 70%, the vast majority of data points are up in here. So we're interested. And we're going to say that's our cutoff for homeodomains. And again, that's consistent with our previous study. Nice to see. So this is the cool part. So there's different families have very different cutoffs. So MIB family, you know, we got a little unlucky here. You know, I was like wishing we could move these up a little bit so we could move the cutoff out, but you know, we're honest people, so here's our line, and you know, it's a higher cutoff for MIB. Yeah, so this is part of this is because we're including data from many other studies. So like Martha's also published a lot of the same constructs. So 100% will often have a lot, just because, you know, she'll do a certain yeast transcription factor, and we did it to, you know, so there's a lot in the 100 bin.
So it's not just data.
No, but for Bee Zips, you can see, you know, you can go a little bit further. So this is, you know, a family that I like, and I didn't show it, but so like here it is up here. So this is all the families that we thought we could draw a line basically. You know, some of them the data is sparse, but you know, you can still see there's a lot of points here, and then there's a shelf. So we'll be conservative and say here's our shelf. Everything above here is our cutoff. But some of them are really weird. So like WRKY, this is a plant transcription factor family. You can go down to like 20%, and you know, you only share 20% of your amino acids. You still recognize the same stupid motif, which gets frustrating because we assayed like 50 of these things and you get the same thing over and over again. It's like, all right. But there are some differences.
You can find a smaller subset and say, well, that's actually the part that matters.
Yeah, see, that is, it's a perfect lead-in to a point that I was just gonna make. Or no, let me go back to one of these. So yeah, so Rob's point is, what about these outliers, right? This is like, I love this in science where you're like, you're happy with the things that fall on the curve, and you're also happy with the outliers. It's like you win no matter what. So the outliers here are really interesting, right? So here's a guy or a pair that are 80% similar, but their motifs have nothing to do with each other. So you can imagine this is a great way to figure out what the amino acids are actually determining the specificity. And likewise, look up here. Here's guys that are 10% similar, but they have the same exact motif, right? Those are probably important residues. So you know, this is, you know, these are all interesting things you can use these data for.
For exactly, what does it mean? Precision is nearly zero. It means that your experimental replicates were not coming anywhere near the level of conservation in the genome.
It means that, so if you are, for example, if you pick a pair of transcription factors and their amino acids are only 10% identical, then you know their motifs are totally dissimilar is basically the idea. Like none of them were as similar as experimental replicates, basically. And I mean, there's some, right? Here's two that probably, you know, were barely above the line, but not too many of them were. Yeah, Mike.
So something about cattle development finding sites, because they're going to be sometimes separated by a distance greater than 10, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. There are. So we have, so B-Zips, for example, this is a obligate dimerization family. They happen to recognize short enough motifs so we can still pick it up. But yeah, so it works for these ones. So one of the caveats of the protein binding microarrays is the longer the motif gets, the less likely as we can measure it. You know, we can tell the experiment just fails. But, you know, there's certain classes to recognize longer motifs that, you know, we resort to other technologies like the C-Lex. So that's where you select these custom protein binding microarrays. So all these are the universal arrays that have this one, you know, 32 copies of each 8-mer aspect. But others, like Martha's done, like NF-kappa-B specific arrays. You can put anything you want on the arrays in terms of sequence. And, you know, we've done this too, where you can say, I'm looking at this pair of transcription factors. This is the allosteric example, where we're just going to design our sequences so that we have variations of those two motifs at different orientations. So you can stick anything you want on it. The universal ones are the ones that have this limitation, really. And it's just a statistical limitation. Like, if you recognize a 15 base sequence, odds are it just doesn't even show up on our array, so you're not going to get any signal. Okay. All right, so you know, hopefully you can squint enough and see that this, you know, you get this basic behavior for pretty much all the families, and, you know, overall the cross-validation rate's about 90%. So, you know, if you're happy with 9 out of 10 of our predictions being as good as experimental replicates, then, you know, now we have these thresholds that we can now infer motifs for. Okay. Oh, yeah. Yeah, so that's kind of the first thing that we ended up looking at is, you know, you can, at least simplistically, you can say, all right, look at the outliers and say, here's ones that we think are important, and then look at the crystal structure and say, aha, we were right. So yeah, for the homeodomains, it's almost, you can almost just look at the alignment and say, yeah, look, these are the 11 that are known to be determined specificity, these are the 6 that are known to contact the DNA. So, but I think that's an aspect of this that has not really been explored very much yet. And I think we can get pretty far with it, looking into that. Okay. All right, so here is just, you know, I was trained as a network guy. And usually I don't think networks are appropriate anymore, so I don't use them very often. But I think this is a case where they actually help intuitively to understand what's going on. So what we're doing here is we're looking at two subfamilies of BZIPs. So again, this is one class of transcription factors. A circle is a transcription factor. So like here's one from Ciona intestinalis. Here's one from Monodelphus domesticus. And I'm linking up a pair of transcription factors if they're above the cutoff for BZIPs, which I think is 55%. So any pair that's linked up means that pair of transcription factors are predicted to have the same DNA binding motif. And, you know, this is just, we're looking at one region of the BZIPs. And, you know, this is kind of an interesting thing that, you know, I don't think necessarily had to happen. But it's very modular, right? So you get these big hairballs of, you know, presumably this is like, you know, one group of transcription factors across many organisms. That are all connected to one another. And then here's another hairball that's totally unconnected to it. And now what we can do is we can superimpose the motifs, just, you know, to show you guys I'm not crazy. So here's mouse June B motif, mouse June motif, as predicted. You know, they're in this hairball together, pretty much the same motif. And then down here, here's another June family motif, which again has, you know, matches that motif. And then again, we're within the same structural class, so these are BZIPs over here, but the NFIL3 motif looks pretty much totally different from there. So, you know, it's not like all BZIPs are gonna recognize the same sequence. There's actually, you know, again, there's subclasses within them. All right? So now let's zoom out a bit. We were looking here at NFIL3 in June, so now this is all the BZIPs. So again, we're looking across the entire family. And so the colors here, red means we or someone else has directly figured out the motif using an experiment. Orange means you're linked up to a red guy, so that means that we can predict your motif because you're similar enough to something that we have data for. And now dark blue are the ones that we picked. So remember I said, let's make our dream team of transcription factors. So the dark blue are the ones that we targeted. And you can see that we just targeted large groups where, you know, we didn't know anything. And then this one is like buy one, get 30 free or whatever. And then light blue are ones that, you know, we could then infer because we targeted that one. So you can see, I got to change the color scheme because blue looks a lot like gray. But, you know, you can see for the BZIPs, we're lighting up this, you know, the universe of transcription factors pretty well. And you can zoom out one more step. Here's all the transcription factors in the eukaryotes. And, you can see, you know, there's big swaths. So like for HomeoBox, you know, we've done a lot of work. So, you know, there's a lot of orange and red in here. But, you know, there's lots of other families. Nuclear receptors, yeah, we're doing pretty good there. You know, all of these, you know, we're getting pretty good coverage of the transcription factors. Yeah. They share what?
They share the DNA sequence motifs, at least in terms of what you
yep.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So in some ways, it's what Andrew was suggesting is not true. The things that are closest to each other, even though the things that bind the DNA are probably a subset of the amino acids, you don't see sufficient divergence of the DNA binding motif because the entire protein has to change significantly for you to actually see variation in the DNA binding motif.
So that's true within reason. So there's also all those outliers I was pointing out, right? So there's certain cases where you can certainly change a single amino acid and all of a sudden, boom, the motif, you know, is different. There's clear examples of that. So it's one of these kind of everyone wins scenarios where, you know, we can within one of these classes, you know, we think that for the most part, you're going to have, you know, there's strong enough constraint on these things, and we figured out the rules reasonably well enough that, you know, this big hairball here is all going to recognize the same motif. But there are going to be exceptions in there. You know, we got, you know, you can look at the cross-validation rate, 10% of them are wrong, right? So, you know, 90% sounds good, but it's also, you know, 10% of them were exceptions. So I think it works both ways, really. All right. So here's our universe. So now let's just look at the numbers of where we are. So these are the families of transcription factors. So I should have mentioned there are about 300 eukaryotic genomes that have been sequenced. You know, I'm sure that number is a lot higher. We're working on, you know, updating everything. Across those 300 species, there's about 11,000 homeodomains, 1,700 MIBs. But this is our coverage. So just out of, you know, if we had all the transcription factors from a given family, our bars would be up here. And then the colors tell you where the information came from. So blue is, you know, I spent a lot of time just compiling all the information across all of the literature, basically. So that's what was previously known, you know, so not very good. Red are the ones we directly assayed in this study. So, you know, these are ones we actually did an experiment for and passed our QC. And in green are the ones that we can infer using these rules. So, you know, that's where you get, you know, the true bang, which again, you know, it's not too surprising because, like, you have a human transcription factor, you know, you probably have the chimp, the gorilla, the orangutan, you know, so you're buying a lot based on, you know, what's been sequenced. But, you know, it's still pretty good to see that for a lot of these classes, you know, we've got good coverage. And then, you know, the converse is now let's look at the species, what our coverage is. So one thing that'll jump out at you is Cerevisiae. You know, a lot has been done for Cerevisiae, so, you know, we didn't really gain much, but, you know, we did a little bit, so, you know. But for a lot of other organisms, you know, we've made a huge amount of progress here. And just pointing out a couple things. So mouse, again, like we and Martha have done a lot of work and others, you know. And again, we're including ChIP-seq. Everything that's determined a motif for is in this database I'm showing you. But, you know, we did a bunch more mouse ones, and then based on this and this, we could infer a lot more. You know, Danio, for example, you know, not a whole lot of directly determined motifs, but a lot of these can be inferred from mouse and human, et cetera. And then I put stars next to kind of, again, if you remember, like the organisms we really focused on. It's like Neurospora went from like nothing to, you know, over 50%. Yeah.
So Giardia is always interesting, it seems like, also for cytoskeleton. So I'm just curious if you have any thought about what's up.
Well, Giardia, we tried. We couldn't get, you know, it was just, we couldn't get any template to work with. So it's kind of missing data here. I'm trying to think about the actual repertoire of transcription factors. If there's anything, I think it's one, and others might be able to correct me, but I think it's one where it's thought to be more post-transcriptional regulation going on. So there's a smaller repertoire of transcription factors, but a lot of what look like RNA binding proteins. But I can't remember if that's Giardia or it's something in this region of the universe. Yeah.
How much of the missing fraction are transcription factors that bind things that are longer than eight?
Yeah. So Some of it, so that some of them, like, some of them are ones, yeah, that we could never measure, but others could. Another thing is the denominator is quite suspect, because remember, we've talked about how I identify these transcriptive factors. They're just scans of the proteome computationally, and we know there's a lot of false positives and false negatives in there. So, you know, these denominators are kind of, you know, they're a little sketchy too. But, you know, they're our best guess. But one of the kind of missions we have now is we're pairing up with, like, experts, you know, that work on different organisms, and we're just trying to curate the lists of transcription factors. Because, you know, there's only so far you can get computationally.
The question about the similarity of binding and the conservation of sequence. You see, maybe you have done this comparison, but if you compare orthologs and paralogs, do you see a different relationship?
So either you or one of our reviewers, or you think like one of our reviewers. So that was a good question. The answer is we did not see a difference. So we did check. We didn't think of that. And then a reviewer asked that, and there was no difference. But it was definitely, I was hoping there'd be something there, because that would have been cool. But.
Was it the OR?
They need to be have a GST tag, though, is the thing. That could work. Yeah, we couldn't use, I don't think we could use our assays. But yeah, mass. Yeah, like I'm. So maybe your review. That was another question. So yeah, this was a really cool thought, I thought. So the idea is there's 32,896 possible ATMERs. When you take all these experiments we've done, what fraction of those ATMERs actually are bound? And I think the answer was about 70%. So there's 30% that we've never observed anything combined to. We kind of made a plot just showing, you know, just several times you can randomly pick, no one's going to see that. You can randomly pick. All right, so here, I'll try and do it like this. Oh, all right, I'll just stop drawing then. Okay, so it kind of approaches asymptotically with the number of experiments, how many ATMERs you cover, and we think we've just about reached saturation. So there could be something about this 30%, and you know we've looked at, you know, simple things like GC content. Like it looks like, you know, if you have stretches of A's or stretches of C's, you know, they're not interested in binding those. But you know there are no obvious, you know, things that jumped out at us. But I think it's another interesting thing. Back to the genomes. Yeah, that's something we haven't really formally done, because we know that a lot of these genomes have huge biases, like an AT content, for example. Then seeing if, you know, how that relates to the transcription factors binding preferences, that could be an interesting thing to do.
So I think I understand the story that you're telling into conservation. Right? You're sort of focused on the conservation, but it seems to me that you should be able to get the same data about how individual promoters or DNA binding motifs are changing across the different lineages as well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So do you see sort of instances of, you know, one change in a protein in a plant, and now the DNA binding motif is quite different? Can you tell those sorts of stories as well?
Yeah, so that was a part of this paper that actually got cut out because the reviewers were too confused by it. But we basically, you can, and so we're making a new paper out of it, but the idea is that you can kind of use these data that trace the evolutionary history of all these things. And you know, there's a lot of, you know, assumptions we're making, but the idea is that if you look at how the protein and the motif have co-evolved, you can kind of infer when these things arose. And so that's the basic idea, and you know I can't remember where that project stands right now, but it should eventually come out. But yeah, that's something, you know, it's certainly something interesting to look at, because you know there are clear relationships between protein and the sequence they recognize, and then you know clearly proteins evolve, clearly the genomes evolved, so you know it's a good data set for looking at this.
Predicting promoters, mm-hmm. genomes, particularly in that set that aren't animal deposit fungi.
Yeah.
You know, where's your gene? Where's your promoter? We don't know.
Yep.
And so the story about conservation is really comforting.
Yep. Actually. Yeah. So, yeah.
You know, promoters a lot better, but they really should be a lot of them.
Yeah.
And plasticity in there, new
yeah. Yeah, and if we, hopefully I'll get to a slide that'll at least kind of speak to your what you said about promoters, too, Mike.
So there's sort of a interpretation difficulty here that there isn't some of the questions. So, I mean, we really don't know what the favorite flavor of the transcription factor is. It's all sort of predicted mm-hmm. statistically, but suppose yep. it really liked an 11 mer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're still going to get a lot of the subsets
yeah.
of the 11 mer that yep. are in
Yep. Yeah, and that's something that I kind of glossed over is we get these measurements for the 8 MERS, but you can of course align the 8 MERS to build out bigger motifs, and that's kind of so we can get up to about 12 base wide motifs using these data. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Is that what you find? Do you find that there's this kind of meandering through motif space over
Yeah, I think Mike has a paper that talks about that just came out. Yeah, but that's pretty much what you see is that you can imagine you have some sort of motif that the things evolve to recognize, and then you can tweak that, and there's a couple of things that Mike argues very nicely in his paper about there's random drift where a lot of these, because of the degeneracy, these things, you can change a base and it won't change anything. So the things are free to kind of drift and evolve. And then there can also be selection acting on it where, you can randomly change something that suddenly binds a lot more strongly and maybe that produces more expression of a gene that maybe is advantageous. But certainly that's the way I think of it is like they're, just point mutation type evolution going on. All right. Okay, so this is now, let's just sum up the numbers across everything. So across the 300 sequence eukaryotes at the time, there are about 160,000 transcription factors. You compile everything up from all the studies out there, about 2,000 of them had a motif, so that was the 98% from like my first slide where we don't know the binding for. And so after this study, we're up to like 40%. And again, because we're buying so much with these inferences, and then you can be a little more lenient and say, all right, I'm fine if half the time you're wrong, then you can get up to 50% coverage here. And this is an ongoing enterprise, so we're looking at 3,000 more proteins recently. So it's going to be an ongoing project. Okay, so good. So this is kind of getting to what Joel was asking about. Now, there's not much time, but now we're going to transition to actually using this data set. So everything's been about building a data set, and now, I get to the fun part of actually using it. So let's, look at promoters across eukaryotes. So, everyone is, excited about enhancers, and I think they're cool too, but I think a lot of people have forgotten about promoters. And I think this will at least show that there's information in promoters, damn it. So here we're showing you for human, here's a small subset of transcription factors we've directly measured their binding specificity of, and then most of them we're inferring from mouse. And we're looking at, we're aligning all the genes in the genome, we're aligning them based on their transcription start site. And now each row here is a different transcription factor, and we're just scanning for its motifs in those genes and saying, where do we see enrichment of that motif relative to the genes? I'm sorry, so I misspoke. So these are the transcription factors, and we're looking across all genes. And where you see a darker box, it means the given transcription factor motif tends to occur at that position relative to genes in the genome. And what you can see here is, green is our random scrambled motifs that are nonsense, basically. Red is just kind of like the integral across all these. And you can see that, motifs in human, in general, peak right around the transcription start site.
So, is it a pair that's that you do to nucleosomes?
Yeah, so that's what we think. We didn't really formally check that, but it sure looks a little nucleosome-y. But, well, no, maybe not on this scale. Yeah,
no, it's
yeah, that's about right. Yeah, okay, yeah. Pretty neat. So yeah, I mean, you can see, you know, visually all these guys are popping up here. And then, so this blue now is just showing the GC content. So in humans, I don't know if you knew this, I thought this is kind of cool. The GC content, of course, you know, it increases as you hit the transcription start site. And it'll be important why I pointed that out in a second. So now let's look at other organisms. So here's plant, fungus, slime mold. So we see the same basic relationship, right? So the red is peaking right near the transcription start site in all these organisms. And this is regardless of the GC content. So like in Rhabdopsis, the GC content dips and then it goes up. For Cerevisiae, it's high and then it dips. And then, you know, for slime mold, it slowly dips. So, but in all cases here, you know, we see that these transcription factor motifs are enriched near the transcription start site. You know, and this is kind of interesting because, you know, we always play this game of what's a promoter. And to me, it looks like it's 200 bases upstream is how far you have to go. You know, because often we'll do, well, let's pick 1,000, let's pick 5,000. And, you know, this is just, if you want to get most of the action, I guess, the 200 bases is good.
Well, what would this look like if we did the same thing up known enhancers?
Ah, that's a good question. I think looking at enhancers, I think there would be almost no signal, right? Because they're kind of scrambled around. You know, unless you, well, what's your question? Are you saying let's extend this out like 100,000 bases that way, or?
Like grab enhancers and ask, I don't know, distribution of binding. I'm just curious.
I would.
It just means stuff binding.
I would predict that there's not going to be any bias towards, you know, either end of the enhancer, and it'd be more like they'd just be mixed up. I bet the motifs would be enriched in enhancers, but I don't think they'd have a location within the enhancer bias. I bet they'd have relative locations relative to one another. So if you had motif A and motif B, they might tend to be within five bases of each other. You know, it's like the enhancosome type model. And like I have other projects looking at that. But yeah, I think making this kind of plot, though, I don't think it would show up. Yeah. I don't know. I can't really answer that. That's a good point. Yeah,
right,
a really good point.
Relative.
Yeah, so there's only like a few percents here. Yep. Yeah, I should have put the scale on there. But I don't. I actually don't know the answer to that. I don't know if anyone else wants to chime in. Joel, do you?
So you're saying that the promoter is approximately 200 upstream and kind of a regular thing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that has anything to do with having a single nucleosome length?
It certainly could be, yeah, because that's, you know, perhaps, you know, at least in yeast, it's thought to be the nucleosome-free region, right? Like, you know, it fits pretty well. It could also have a lot to do with just, you know, the mechanics of how far away you can be with loading RNA polymerase and, you know, everything directly before you're too far away. And, you know,
how big are these proteins? I mean, so I really don't know. How big are these proteins compared that you're looking at compared to how long 200 nucleotides of DNA would be in a human? So is it just that's the physical size?
If you get a large complex, it would start to build up. You know, you can, there's, you know, if you look at crystal structures, you can see, like, you know, the actual, just the binding domains of the proteins are fitting in, you know, on the order of dozens of bases. But if you have a large complex, you know, that can build up to be, you know, like 100. Yeah, so yeah, I mean, and there's a lot of things happening at the promoter. So, yeah, that could also be a factor. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering about the RNA polymerase machinery, because it's kind of interesting that, you know, where the red line peaks is different in different organisms.
Yeah.
So do we know anything about the differences in the polymerase machinery between
these? Yeah, so for DICTY, I just want to point out it's an artifact because the TSS is not very well defined, the transcription start site, so we had to use the translation start site. So it's, you know, probably if we knew the TSS, this would move over. But for the others, yeah, I mean, it looks like, you know, yeast, clearly we have good data for that, and it's more about 50 bases upstream. Well, maybe it's about the same for the others then. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, there could be various biases.
Yeah. And again, we're biased also by the coverage, because even for human, you know, we only know binding motifs for about 50% of the transcription factors. For yeast, it's more like we've got them all, so we kind of have a more complete picture in yeast.
For human and yeast, on the very left side, real data and random are the same, while for two others, real data are well below random.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the being below is there's actually a depletion for the true motifs, right? And that's a really interesting point that I hadn't really thought about. So the point is, for human here, you know, real and random is essentially equivalent. So there's, you know, you can think of it as no signal until you hit closer to TSS. Versus, you know, let's say Dicty over here, you know, there's actually a depletion for the motifs. And I'd never thought of it, but that's actually a good point. There could be something there. Some sort of, selection. Maybe, yeah, because if you could imagine, you know, in, you know, a simpler organism, if you had, you know, if you have things binding too far from the TSS, that might actually screw things up more because you have, you know, less kind of error checking or less, you know, complicated mechanisms that correct for it. So you actually might have selection against things binding too far because you kind of want to push them towards the TS. I don't know. I'm speculating, you know, because that's an interesting point. But yeah.
This is checking where the motifs are in the organism. Do you check to make sure that the organism has something that would bind that motif?
Yeah. So we're only using transcription factors from that organism.
Okay.
Yep. Okay, so I got about 5 minutes left. Okay, so just to wrap up, I wanted to, you know, so we're, again, this, there was a good point at the beginning that we're measuring the binding of a transcription factor, and a lot more goes into controlling gene expression than just a single transcription factor, what sequence is it combined to, but you can use these data to start tying to actual phenotypes. So in this case, we're looking at gene expression, and we're looking at Arabidopsis, but you can really do this in any organism where these data are available. But here, so this is an EQTL, they're called. So the idea is that if you have a G at this SNP, you have low expression of this gene, and if you have an A, you have higher expression. And, you know, and often we look at this in the context of human diseases, but you can think about it as really any, you know, it doesn't have to be in a disease context. So now what you can do is with this motif library, we can play the game of, all right, let's look at the SNP, here it is, G to an A, look at the flanking bases and try and figure out what transcription factor could be binding it. And, you know, here's, you know, our prediction here is it's this VNI2 transcription factor, because you can see it's a great match to the reference allele and it's a terrible match to the alternative allele. So the prediction here would be it's a repressor, right? Because if you have the G, it can bind and it turns off expression, but if you have the A, the expression goes up. And then, indeed, it actually is a well-known repressor, and, you know, these two genes are involved in similar pathways, so, you know, this is a way that you can kind of make predictions about the function of the transcription factors and also try and understand mechanistically what's happening when you observe these EQTLs. And, you know, quickly, just to, maybe I'll skip this example and go to a more tangible one. Okay, so we work on lupus, so we're in this autoimmune genomics group. So what we've been doing is trying to interpret the function of these non-coding variants, which are associated with different human diseases. So this one in particular, we have collaborators, John Harley and Leah Cadian, where it's upstream this IRF5 gene, which turns out it's a transcription factor too. It's one of the most strong signals of association in lupus, and we know that IRF5 is overexpressed in lupus patients. So it's the kind of setup of what I just showed you, where if you have the risk alleles for IRF5, you have higher expression. And they've done some careful statistical genetic modeling to narrow it down to, they think it's really this variant that is the true association, and they did this using targeted deep sequencing of thousands of lupus patients and controls. And then we also know from other studies that some mystery protein binds more strongly to the risk allele when, you know, in blood cell nuclear extracts. So we can play, just to show you the context, here's IRF5. The 5' end is here. This is the UTR, first exon, second exon, introns, et cetera. And there are SNPs located out here. It's a little outside the promoters that I was showing you, but in humans, that's really perfectly fine. And then, you know, a lot of what we do is you layer on data from other sources. So these are all data from ENCODE. We use all sorts of different sources. And you can see that there's peaks here. These pink peaks mean that this particular histone mark is present where the SNP is, and this is a mark that tells you this is likely an active regulatory region. And that cell type in pink corresponds to B cells, which are thought to be one of the major cell types important for lupus. So you can see, and there's also another histone mark where it's pink peaking, and it's near these open regions of chromatin and B cells, but it doesn't overlap any ChIP-seq data for any transcription factors. So, you know, if it overlapped, you know, STAT1 binding site, we might predict it would affect STAT1, but we don't have any leads here, basically, based on the ChIP-seq data. So what we can do is play the same game. So we know the alleles of the SNP. It changes a G to an A, and then we can say we know something is binding more strongly to the RISC, so what is it? And it turns out ZBTB3 is, you know, it's a fun transcription factor to say, and there's not much known about it, but that's our prediction. So from the protein binding microarrays, it goes from these things we call E scores, where it's probably not at all going to bind. This is a very bad score. They range from negative 0.5 to positive 0.5. And it goes to 0.45, which anything above that is thought to be strong binding. And then we also know ZBTB3, we don't know much about it, but we know it's highly expressed in B cells. So our prediction here is that if you have the RISC allele of this variant, it's creating a binding site for ZBTB3 in B cells, and that explains why there's higher expression of IRF5 in lupus patients. And then, you know, in the paper, it's published, we can show, we've done experiments to show that at least we're right about ZBTB3 differentially binding, and now we're kind of pursuing it further, trying to get into the whole genome editing thing to show this is a causal variant, and it's actually affecting this phenotype. Okay, and just to end, we have a website, so if you're interested in this kind of stuff, we've spent a lot of time building our website. This is the URL down here, but you can really just Google CISBP or even my name, and it'll come up. But it's, you know, we designed it to be as easy to use if you're computational or non-computational. You can kind of just enter a transcription factor. You can browse by organism, browse by domain, family, et cetera, et cetera. Each page, there's 160,000 transcription factors. Each one has a page that looks like this. You know, so for CREB1, here's a motif that was directly determined. This is taken from a different database because, again, we compiled information from all sorts of places. And then this is showing you, based on DNA binding domain, here's related transcription factors. So human CREB1's related to the mouse CREB1. Here's the motif. And again, you know, it looks just like that one. We have downloads. So for computational people, you click twice and you get the entire database. I think that's important. I wish more people would do that. Tools page. So we have simple tools for scanning a DNA sequence, doing that SNP analysis I showed you. If you have a protein and you want to know what motif it might recognize, you can put in its amino acid sequence. If you have a motif and you want to know what protein it might bind it, you can put that in here. And again, for all these, you can select what species you want. So, you know, again, any organism you're interested in. And then we have, you know, it's green instead of blue, but there's also an RNA binding protein version. Okay, so that's everything. This was done, again, while I was a postdoc with Tim Hughes at the University of Toronto. There's a huge team of people that helped out on this. Ali, in particular, did virtually all the experiments, which is absolutely amazing. Mihai, he's a bioinformatician that helped a lot with building a web server. And then, you know, lots of other people contributed experimental help here. And then we had lots of collaborators. So Joe Ecker helped. His lab did a lot of the Arabidopsis stuff. Lou Larondo, Neurospora. And then, you know, other people in diminishing returns of help. And, you know, here's the reference down here. And I have a new lab now in Cincinnati. I left the slide out, but, you know, this is kind of like the past and the future is we're trying to use these data, not just in a disease context, but also to really understand, you know, how evolution works in terms of transcription factors and even how transcription factors work in general. So, all right, that's it. Thank you. Ed.
That's a really cool example of tracking down the effect of this allele. But it made me wonder because you only have six nucleotides and you didn't need a perfect match.
Ah.
There must be just a ton of places that have as good a match somewhere in the genome.
Yep.
So how could one, other than, you know, going from the point of, okay, there are people who do genetics or people study the patients and sort of figure out which is the relevant allele, and then you come up with a transcription factor. But
that's a
way.
key dirty secret you've arrived at. So you know, these things are so degenerate, it's just a property of the system that they recognize short degenerate motifs. So if you give me a SNP and it's like changing something to a TAAT, for example, I'm gonna come back at you with like 70 transcription factor candidates. And this one, we were lucky that there's only one. And we're like, all right, let's pursue that one. But yeah, if you give a, you know, just depending on the sequence, you know, these things come in large families and then degenerate motifs they recognize. So that's where then we layer other information on, like what's the expression level of the transcription factor in relevant cell types. You know, ideally, collaborator has like RNA-seq and, you know, patient-derived cells or something, and we can say, well, this transcription factor is actually highly expressed in these cells. But yeah, that's, you definitely need to use other information in cases like that.
You didn't really say why there's a change in the GC content in the upstream region. I mean, is it that we're selecting for the presence of the binding sites which changes the GC content, or is it that there's some mutational bias going on in that region which changes the GC content and then the transcription factor binding sites have to live with that?
It's a good point. So in mammals, at least, we have these CpG islands, which are, you know, they're a major factor here. Basically, you can methylate the CG, and that can, classically, that's thought to shut down the action. So you methylate a bunch of CGs, nothing can bind the area, but there are actually certain transcription factors that prefer to bind to the methylated CG, which is, you know, another talk altogether. But the crux of your question is, you know, why is this, so that's one explanation, is there's CpG islands in mammals and not in other organisms. So that's like a factor that's, you know, driving, you know, the differences. But, you know, I guess that's the best answer I can give. I really don't know the answer to why, because I mean, there's different organisms too. Like there's certain organisms that are like 80% AT, and I don't know why that is either. Maybe someone does. it's something I should be able to give a better answer for, but I don't really know. Shelley? Yeah. So the question then is, can we kind of turn the problem on its side and say, given that we know a transcription factor's motif, can we then scan the genome and say it's going to be regulating this class of genes, right? That kind of like. And I think that's something you can do in, you can't really do that in animals so much because just statistically, the search space is so huge, where, you know, you have a, like 100 kb of region that could be regulating your genes, and, you know, you're going to find matches all over the place to everything there. But like in other organisms, like paramecium, like in Mike's studies with the really short promoters, I think it's perfect for that kind of exercise, because then you have like 40 bases, you don't have quite as many transcription factors, and you can pretty much just line them up and say, all right, this one's probably regulating this gene, and then you look at all the classes of genes that might be regulating and look for commonalities. So yeah, that's certainly a, and people do that in yeast a lot, for sure.
I think we're going to, it's great to have all these questions. Matt's around for the rest of the week.
Yep.
He needs a break right now because he's meeting with the students at 11, I guess, next door. Is that correct?
Yep.
Okay, so the students should all show up next door at 11.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.